Brewster, good morning to you. Before you begin, Ms. George, or Ms. Osborne, you are also here. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
I don't believe so. We've got 20 minutes apiece. Is that right for this?
You do.
Anybody need a break up there? Or you have. I've been sitting back here watching.
I think we're okay.
Okay.
Well, you may proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Your Honor, my name's Charles Brewster with Anderson, Klein, Brewster, and Brandt of Kearney. Today, my co-counsel is Carson Messersmith, who has helped with the briefing in this matter and trying to figure it out. I thought that I might first just give you a brief recap of what happened with this. This is out of the Lincoln County District Court, and in North Platte, on May 22nd of 2020, my client, Keith Allen, was with his girlfriend, Amanda Beal, and they were driving around North Platte in Amanda Beal's little Ford car. At the time...
In downtown North Platte.
Downtown North Platte. At the time, Keith Allen and Amanda Beal were kind of girlfriend, boyfriend, you know, on and off again, and Amanda had a relationship going with a fellow named Brett Torres. And Mr. Torres is described as kind of middle-aged, great big guy, 6'4", 300 pounds, you know, like that. Mr. Torres was not happy about Amanda hanging out with Keith Allen, and he saw the little Ford driving around with Amanda driving and Keith as a passenger, and so he gave chase. And they drove around downtown North Platte, and my client lived in downtown North Platte, basically, and they pulled up in an alleyway behind his house. Mr. Torres pulled up next to him. The windows were rolled down. Harsh words were exchanged. Mr. Torres began to get out of the vehicle in a hurried manner. My client, who was armed with a .45 automatic pistol, shot and killed him. Those are the basics of what happened. Again, this was in May of 2020. Skip forward to October of 2021. There was a trial in the District Court of Lincoln County. Keith Allen was charged with first-degree murder and use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. The Lincoln County Attorney's Office represented the state, and if you read the record, did a pretty darn good job putting the case on. Mr. Allen had court-appointed counsel, and they did what they could to defend the matter. There were some problems during the case, Your Honor. And that's what I'm here to talk about today. The biggest problem with the case has to do with jury misconduct. We don't see that very often in our court system, thankfully. The law, there's not a whole lot of law about it. There's some in Nebraska, there's some from around the United States, but the situation was this. Mr. Torres' family, a very large family in the North Platte area, they attended the trial, Mr. Torres, there was evidence adduced by defense counsel to the jury, was a pretty violent fellow. He liked to resolve issues with violence, and so there was evidence to that effect. When the jury got the case after instructions from the district judge, they went into the jury room, I believe about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and they started talking about the case. And one of the jurors, according to an affidavit by the foreman, brought up the fact that, well, if we acquit this guy, if we acquit Keith Allen, then, you know, the Torres family may come after us in mafia style.
Was there any evidence that a threat had been made to the jury?
No, sir.
Okay.
There was no evidence to that effect. The only thing that, that there was, this was brought up by more than one juror, that, you know, the Torres family, you know, they deal with problems in a basically violent way. This was the information that was shared with the jurors.
Our case law has talked about juror misconduct, or specifically as to the evidence, whether or not it's admissible, this, on the evidentiary issue, has talked about external causes, external influences brought to bear. But aren't you talking about something that's purely internal to the deliberations of the jury?
Your Honor, I don't think so. And this is why. It's external because it has to do with the, you know, the family members that are in the courtroom, and apparently, you know, they were quite, you know, vocal from time to time during the course of the trial and the view of the jury, and they're out there. That's external, and that perception apparently brought at least a couple of the jurors to say, hey, we've got the Torres family out there. They're not very happy about, you know, Brett getting killed, and you know, we might have a real problem if we enter an acquittal in this matter. So I think that's where the external comes in. That's a good question.
So, but doesn't that, isn't that sort of a circular approach, in the sense that anything that a juror brings into the jury room that somehow relates to something or someone else outside is now fair game under the evidentiary statute? That, to me, is a little difficult to cross that bridge.
Well, okay, so, and I've thought about this a lot, too, because it's not exactly crystal clear, and the reason it's not crystal clear is because we're dealing with human beings and perceptions, and you just never know. But what I would suggest to the court is that this information brought in, it had nothing to do with the evidence submitted to the jurors at trial.
It was brought in by a juror. It wasn't brought in
exactly
by someone else.
Right.
And you have to prove that it was brought in, and you rely on the affidavit that the trial court rejected under the 2760, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's 6062.
Right.
Which I think was an error on the trial court's part.
But you would agree, if it was not error in terms of admitting that or refusing to admit that exhibit, you don't have any evidence to justify juror misconduct.
Okay. So, if the court becomes aware of information, not evidence, but information that there may have been juror misconduct, and if it's the exception, that is extraneous prejudicial information that influenced the jury and was prejudicial, if the court becomes aware of that, then it's the court's duty to investigate this, to find out what really happened. And the trial court didn't do that.
Is the allegation alone enough to require the court to do it, or does there have to be some showing before that becomes mandated? And if so, what was the showing here of acceptable evidence?
Well, if it's something like this, Justice, I think that a trial court judge needs to pay attention to it. I mean, my criminy, what's the worst possible thing that a juror could be thinking about in deciding the guilt or innocence of someone accused of first-degree murder? The worst possible thing would be, oh my gosh, if I acquit this guy, you know, my house might get burned down or something like that.
Would the basis of the juror's concern be some external factor that could be identified? So the families in the gallery giving the jurors the stink eye, something like that.
So, in the affidavit, Exhibit 300, which was not admitted into evidence, which I believe was error, But there was, thankfully, an offer of proof of that, and it is part of the record. In answer to your question, in that affidavit, there was an indication that two of the jurors knew of this family, and they knew that they had a propensity for handling problems on their own, which is what I believe the exhibit said. And so...
You would agree in a town the size of North Platte, it's not unusual for people to know families around town. It's not like Lincoln or Omaha, where they're pretty much anonymous. North Platte's closer to the smaller sides of Nebraska rather than the bigger towns.
It's a big cow town.
Big cow town.
Yep. It's
so presumably, even under the way your affidavit is read, presumably those jurors brought that knowledge with them from the moment they appeared for voir dire. Isn't that true?
I would think so, but if they weren't queued up with the fact that, oh gosh, you know, we're talking about Brett Torres, who has a reputation for being violent, for, you know, beating people up when he's unhappy, you know, maybe it didn't click at the time during the voir dire. I don't know how good a job of voir dire was done.
But isn't voir dire the time that issues like this are to be addressed?
They are. You know, Your Honor, I think if there are deficiencies with the trial bar, it's knowing how to properly do a voir dire. And there's some lawyers that are really good at it. You know, Justice Connolly, if you ever, you know, saw him do a voir dire, it was just poetry in motion. And he knew how to get people to answer. But there aren't many of us that can do that. So that's kind of off the topic, obviously. But in any event, it's our position that the court, and this case is a little bit of a nightmare for the trial court. You know, they had evidentiary issues that were really bizarre. The eyewitness to the shooting, Amanda Beal, she didn't testify by stipulation between counsel for the state and defense counsel.
That particular issue you have listed as ineffective assistance of counsel. Do you believe that the record's sufficient for us to address that?
I know full well how difficult it is to get an ineffective assistance of counsel claim ruled in the favor of the defendant. I mean, it's very, very difficult. My client insisted that we assert that, so that's what I did. Far be it from me to second guess experienced trial counsel. But I wouldn't have done that.
Well, on direct appeal, we don't necessarily know what the trial strategy was, what pros were coming with the cons. We don't know that consideration.
You're absolutely right.
That maybe is a post-conviction issue if that were to be the case down
there. Yeah. But I had to bring it up here because I knew about it.
Exactly.
Are there details alleged as to what the girlfriend,
Beal
would have testified to?
Well, she certainly, you know, could have testified about what happened leading up to the shooting. She could have testified how it was impossible for Keith Allen to retreat from the situation because he was essentially almost pinned into his car by the virtue of Brett Torres' Tahoe door up against it. Since he was a passenger, he couldn't get out of the Beal vehicle. He had some orthopedic issues that he was dealing with. He often had to walk with a crutch. So I think Amanda Beal would have been a very important witness. As I understand the discussion, not particularly the most stable person, but I think you put him on the witness stand, Your Honor, and you ask him what happened, and you go from there. And I think it was a real mistake for Mr. Allen's trial counsel to not do that, to stipulate to what the cop was going to say, because Investigator Erickson, the law enforcement officer, he testified to what Amanda Beal told him in an interview after the shooting, and you know, some of it seemed a little bit slanted. Plus, trial counsel for Mr. Allen couldn't cross-examine Amanda Beal.
Had Ms. Beal's deposition been taken?
No. And I don't have an answer for why. But
Did the state and defense counsel both attempt to bring Ms. Beal to court?
Yes, and I think that at one point they had her there, and then they started talking about the stipulation, and I don't know if she disappeared before they got the stipulation in place or after, but defense counsel should have subpoenaed her there and made efforts to make sure that she stayed there. So, the other aspect of ineffective assistance of counsel that I'll just briefly touch on here has to do with another little bit of an evidentiary nightmare for the court. The autopsy that was performed on Mr. Torres by Dr. Okoye, whose name keeps popping up in jurisprudence around the state from time to time, wasn't done properly. And so...
Are you referring to the missed bullet holes, essentially?
Yeah. And I think what probably happened to Dr. Okoye is he's got this great big guy stretched out on the, you know, the stainless steel table, and he's, you know, 300-plus pounds. And I don't know if he didn't read the reports very carefully from the ER, but he didn't turn him over to find the other holes that were in his back. There was also some testimony by Dr. Lindy about how something that Dr. Okoye did to excise the heart wasn't done right. And she took exception to that, as I understand it. But in any event, under those kind of circumstances, it's my opinion that in a first-degree murder case, trial counsel needs to object vigorously to any scientific evidence that's put before the court to make darn sure that there's good foundation, to make darn sure that everything is as it should be to preserve the record, and Mr. Allen's trial counsel did not do that.
Is your argument that the state couldn't get this evidence in the way they did get it in?
I don't know if they could have or not. You know, Justice, maybe, I don't know, I wasn't there, it's something my client wanted me to bring up, so that's what I'm doing. I think it was kind of shaky the way they did it. And,
does the fact that the obvious strategy of those being pursued by defense counsel was self-defense, and that even the defendant admitted to shooting individual multiple times from close range, does that alleviate some of the prejudicial effect of this?
Yes, I think it does. I'd be blowing smoke at you if I had said no. My client was in a situation where self-defense, in his mind, and it only has to be in his mind, in self-defense of Amanda Beal, who wasn't there to testify about how she was afraid, this is a case of self-defense, and that's what, you know, trial counsel asserted, and the jury didn't buy it. The jury didn't deliberate very long, and it is my position that the jury was influenced by those extraneous pieces of information, and that their verdict was not a product of, you know, the kind of deliberations that we like to see, but it was a product of fear. And justices, we can't have that in our system. We can't let that happen. Please. If you reverse it, it'll go back, it'll get retried. You know, the other aspect of this, if those jurors did what it appears that they did, they violated all the court's instructions about ignoring outside things, and I mean, they just, it seems like they ignored most of those instructions, and that is wrong. So I would ask you to reverse this conviction, and I thank you very much for your time and your very good questions.
Thank you very much.
And I'll turn it over to my learned colleague,
Ms. Osborne, good morning to you again.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellee in the state of Nebraska. In this case, appellant admits that he shot and killed the victim, Brett Torres, but argues that he did it in self-defense. There are two primary issues, the sufficiency of the evidence and whether there was jury misconduct. I'll submit the claims of ineffective counsel in the briefs unless the court has specific questions. Appellant raises several arguments, assigned errors related to the district court's denial of his motion for new trial based on an allegation of jury misconduct. At the hearing, appellant offered Exhibit 300, which contains statements about the jury's internal deliberations, including the affidavit actually says that every juror knew something about the Torres family, their reputation in the community, and that some comment was made about what might happen if the outcome was not what the victim's family wanted.
What we're talking about is, what would the state's definition of extraneous prejudicial information be? How would you suggest the court define that?
Court has discussed it in several opinions that are all cited in the state's brief. The word extraneous means existing or originating outside or beyond, external in origin, coming from the outside, brought in, introduced, or added from an external source. The issue here...
So what would an example of that be?
Well, an example could be if somebody on the jury researched an issue that was relevant to the case.
How is that different of what... as to what happened here?
This information that's being alleged is the personal knowledge and experience of the jurors that they brought into the jury room prior to trial. This court has already found in multiple cases that does not constitute extraneous information under 27606 subsection 2.
Would it be different if one of the jurors walked in the room and started talking about all kinds of personal knowledge about the defendant for being violent and matters that weren't before them from the evidence at the trial?
Based on their personal knowledge, not based on...
Based on the personal knowledge they had from just interacting with that person in the community.
I still think that would be extraneous information. That's their personal knowledge. That's something that could have been brought up and asked in voir dire.
You're saying it's not extraneous.
I'm saying that it is extraneous... Yeah, correct. It does not constitute extraneous information. It's their personal knowledge. Sorry, we're getting too many knots in here. They brought it in there with them. It wasn't brought to their attention from an extraneous source.
During the proceedings.
During the proceedings, correct.
So if a juror had received a threat during the proceedings and brought that into the jury room, that would be extraneous.
Absolutely. That would be extraneous. If they received a bribe and brought during the proceedings, that would be extraneous. And that would also actually fall under the second section of whether any outside influence was improperly brought to bear upon a juror. It's not just extraneous information, it's any outside influence, which that would be. This is not extraneous information. the jurors brought it with them. This court has agreed with other courts that have stated that such information, even though it wasn't adduced at trial, is better deemed internal information because it did not come to the jury's attention from a source outside of their membership.
Is the voir dire in our record?
I believe it is, yes. I think the entire voir dire is in the record. Several jurors indicated, as you pointed out earlier, this is a relatively small community. Several jurors indicated that they were familiar with the victim or and also with the defendant, that they had either worked with a family member, they went to school together. There were several jurors that had knew the prosecutor or defense counsel.
Does that mean that the defendant has waived this argument?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that that's the proper time to address this issue. There are several safeguards built into our system. And the appellant brought up Pena-Rodriguez versus Colorado, which really has absolutely nothing to do with this case. It doesn't apply because that relates to racial discrimination, which isn't involved here. But it's interesting, the discussion that the U.S. Supreme Court had in that case, both in the opinion and in the dissenting opinions. They talk extensively about the safeguards that are ingrained in the system. Jurors can be examined for impartiality during voir dire. During the trial, the jury is observable by the court, counsel, and court personnel. Any juror can report misconduct before the jury renders its verdict. Somebody felt that was an inappropriate comment in the jury room. The jury foreman, who is the one who authored the affidavit, could have sent a note to the judge and said, well, I think an inappropriate comment has been made, and I want the court to know about it before the verdict. None of that happened here. So
does our record tell us how this came to the attention of defense counsel?
The second affidavit, which is Exhibit 301, is defense counsel's affidavit, and that was received basically just to explain how defense counsel became aware of this, not for any of the hearsay that it contains. But it essentially, the jury foreman apparently had some random conversation with somebody in town who was familiar with the defendant, and that was reported back to defense counsel, and then he sent out a questionnaire, I think, to all the jurors asking them to respond, is my understanding of essentially how this information came out. And that was several months after the verdict. For all these reasons, the personal knowledge of the jurors about the victim's family, that all existed prior to trial. It's not extraneous information. Under the statute, the juror who wrote that affidavit was precluded from submitting evidence on such matters, and the district court correctly concluded that that affidavit was inadmissible. Because that was inadmissible, the appellant was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing on the allegations because his only proffered evidence was not received as inadmissible affidavit. And since his allegations were unsupported by any evidence, the district court did not abuse its discretion by denying the motion for new trial. And as I stated, the Pena-Rodriguez case doesn't apply. That's a very narrow exception, and it's actually an exception to the extraneous rule, because in that situation, that is not extraneous information that was discussed, and it's a very narrow exception only for racial discrimination. Moving then to, if there's no further questions on that, the sufficiency of the evidence claim, appellant asserts that no rational trier of fact could have found that he killed Torres purposely and with deliberate and premeditated malice rather than in self-defense. We disagree. The appellate standard review requires substantial deference to the factual findings of the jury, and they found the necessary elements of first-degree murder. Purposely means intentionally. Allen's intent to kill Torres can be inferred from his deliberate use of a firearm in a manner reasonably likely to cause death. Here, he intended clearly to kill Torres when he shot him at least 9 times from just about 2 feet away, causing 13 entrance wounds to his body. It resulted in his near immediate death. The firearm he used was a semi-automatic, so that means he had to pull the trigger at least 9 times. Deliberate means not suddenly or rashly, requires the defendant to consider the probable consequences of the act before doing the act. There was evidence that a month prior to the shooting, Allen had sent messages to Amanda Beal, the female involved in the situation here, where he threatened to kill the victim. In fact, that is the only documented threat to kill. It came from the defendant. It is evident that the appellant disliked Torres. He described him in his own words as just a drug-dealing junkie. On the day of the shooting, the appellant's opportunity to carry out this prior threat materialized. He articulated his thoughts even before the victim pulled up next to him in the other vehicle by saying out loud, "All I need is a clear shot." The female, Amanda Beal, heard him say this. She's sitting right next to him in the vehicle. At that point, Allen formed a design to commit the killing of the victim without legal justification before it was done, meaning he acted with premeditated malice. The act was deliberate because he had an opportunity to consider the consequences before doing the act. He simply just waited for the victim to open his car door, which is the clear shot that he wanted, and he took it. There's also evidence to suggest that Allen may have lured Torres out of the vehicle before he shot him. There was an independent witness. He's not associated with anybody involved in this case. He just happened to be on the phone in the front yard near the location of the shooting. He heard a male with a deep voice, which matches the description of the victim, Torres in this case, arguing with another male. The other male said, get out, fight me like a man, get out of the vehicle. The jury could have believed this witness's testimony, and viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, it was the appellant who uttered those words, which indicates his intent to lure the victim out of his vehicle. When Torres opened his driver's door, Allen admits that he immediately discharged his weapon, firing at least 9 rounds into the victim at virtually point-blank range before the victim ever made it out of the vehicle. That's consistent with the forensic evidence that shows that nearly all of Torres' wounds were sustained on the left side of his body, meaning that he, in fact, did not have an opportunity to get out of the vehicle before the defendant started shooting him. As for the theory of self-defense, there was a self-defense instruction. As the finders of fact, the jury rejected that claim.
Was there also a defense of others instruction?
It just says the defendant did not act in self-defense. In the elements instructions, and it, when you go to the self-defense instruction, it says the defendant did not provoke any force against him or Amanda Beal. It references the female, who would be the only other person. So incorporated in the self-defense instruction, it does refer to both him, both the appellant, and Amanda Beal.
The instructional error has not been alleged.
No, it has not. For Allen's actions to be justified, he must have had a reasonable and good faith belief in the necessity of using force. Additionally, the deadly force that he did use must have been immediately necessary and justified under the circumstances. It's important to consider that the appellant's belief must have been objectively reasonable. So in order to successfully claim self-defense, Allen must have had an objectively reasonable basis for his purported belief that Torres was going to shoot him or Beal. And it has to be that he was going to shoot them, because if it was anything less than that, he could have just rolled up his window, locked the doors. They were in a vehicle, in fact, a mobile vehicle. They could have driven away. He didn't ask her to drive away. It's undisputed that the victim in this case did not have a weapon of any kind. He didn't have a weapon on his person. He didn't have a weapon in the vehicle. His passenger didn't have a weapon. The victim's passenger testified that the victim did not make any threats towards the appellant or Beal before the shooting. Allen also admits that he never saw a weapon. Of course, he couldn't have seen a weapon because there wasn't one. He just assumed that the victim was going to get out of his vehicle and shoot him based on threats that he claims that he saw before the incident. So this is where the standard of proof is particularly relevant, because we view the evidence in light most favorable to the state. The jury was not required to give any weight or credibility to the appellant's testimony, and the only evidence that Torres ever threatened to kill the appellant came only from the appellant himself and nobody else, no other evidence. The only threatening language that the victim, that we know that the victim sent, were in messages that he sent to Amanda Beal the previous day. Those are in the record. First, Amanda Beal was the recipient of those messages, not the appellant. The messages do not refer specifically to the appellant, and they were sent in the context of a disagreement between the two. The victim was upset that Amanda Beal had not returned a Walmart receipt. He wanted this receipt because he wanted to return items that he had purchased for her a few days before, prior to them breaking up. And she was non-responsive. He was getting upset, being belligerent, calling her names, and after she sent a message back saying, "I'll return the receipt if you stop threatening me," he apologized, and from then on, their communications were entirely civil. They continued exchanging messages back and forth, including the day of the shooting. Allen, the appellant, also knew that the receipt had been returned by the time of the shooting, because he actually followed Amanda Beal out to the victim's residence when she put it in his mailbox. So he knew that that dispute had already been resolved. She was also uncertain about whether she even told the appellant about these messages. So it's unclear whether he even knew about them. But even if he did know about them, was aware of them, they do not create an objectively reasonable belief that when the victim pulled up next to him the following day that he was going to shoot anyone. Beal never said that she believed that the victim was going to shoot them when he pulled up next to them. And then there's also evidence that even if Allen reasonably felt that he had been threatened for some reason, that he could have tried to escape the situation, and he did not do so. Allen and Beal were in an operational motor vehicle. When they first saw the victim, rather than tell her to drive to the police station, the sheriff's office was only 3 blocks away. They were right next to the federal building. He didn't tell her to go to any of those places. He told her to drive home. And he also never told her to drive away when Torres, either when he pulled up next to them in the vehicle or when he opened the door to get out, he never told her to drive away. Despite both of them having cell phones in the car, neither one of them felt threatened enough to call 911 before the shooting. There's also Well, the appellant relies extensively on his lack of mobility. There is some conflict in the evidence about the extent of that. Multiple independent witnesses testified he did not appear to have difficulty getting around, that he was taking his stairs two at a time, going up to his front door after just moments after the shooting. So viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, a rational trier of fact could conclude.
I think there was some evidence that the defendant had fibromyalgia or other debilitating condition.
Sure, yes. There was a conflict in the evidence. There was evidence that he may have some issues with mobility. There were also witnesses who said he did not have issues with mobility immediately following the shooting. So viewing that evidence in light most favorable to the state, a rational trier of fact could conclude that the appellant did not have a reasonable and good faith belief in the necessity of using deadly force against the victim, or that he did not attempt to get away when he could have done so safely. There's also an argument about sudden quarrel. There has to be a sufficient provocation. All I would say is, all I need is a clear shot. That's a deliberative statement. It does not indicate an incapacity for reflection. So for all those reasons, the evidence was sufficient for both convictions. Unless the court has further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time before we go?
There are 7 seconds.
7 seconds, Mr. Brewster.
Your Honor, I don't think I can say much in 7 seconds from all the way.
Thank you very much. Were you appointed in this matter?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your service. Counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus Allen. Since you are excused and the court is adjourned.